And now, it's time for the biggest bonanza in podcasting. With Dominic Stern and Nicholas Hodel, this is the College Basketball Bonanza.
And here we go. Welcome into the College Basketball Bonanza on what has been a crazy second round Sunday already. I'm Nicholas Hodel, Dominic Stern, a third member of our team. Dom Contini is here as well. Great transition in with one shining moment already, which is typically our outro tradition, but we'll take the intro as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're just a couple of weeks away from the real one shining moment, but definitely getting a little bit of juice going along to beef up. It's a one shining moment sandwich tonight on the Bonanza.
Yes, it is. And we've got a jam-packed show. That includes two segments, actually, out of the East region. And the first one's North Carolina. I mean, this is their weekend was just, whoo boy, it was nuts. I mean, starting off with a complete demolition of Marquette in the first round, which was a complete demolition in every facet of the game, 95-63. And then the game against Baylor, it was looking like a repeat, cruise control, and then man, it got ejected, and then all kinds of craziness broke out from there. And really, I pretty much knew from the start that this would be the league segment. I didn't think anything else would upend it, and it has not, because this is the lead right now. But that North Carolina Baylor game in particular was wild toward in that second half.
Yeah, I've liked this North Carolina team all tournament long. They play defense with a lot of speed. They like to run. They can shoot it. I've said this multiple times. I think Armando Bacot is the best big man in the country. And Brady Manick, he was a big piece in that Baylor, getting that lead over Baylor early on. And then him going out kind of made North Carolina struggle and made the game a lot more entertaining for us, at least. But I think this North Carolina team can definitely beat this UCLA team coming out on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, and this team, Brady Manick's been such a key part of this team, and it really was the big reason why when Manick got ejected, this team looked incredibly wobbly.
Yeah, he had 26 points in 28 minutes, going 4 of 8 from deep, 4 of 5 from on the interior, and 6 of 8 at the free throw line, but he's just a guy who could handle the ball.
Yep.
And that's something they lost. They had to bring in Justin McCoy, who hadn't really played a whole lot on the season. North Carolina's not a deep team by any stretch of the imagination, which is kind of funny because when we think of those true blue-blood North Carolina teams, they can go 8-9 guys.
Yep.
But this team had really only been running 6-7 guys. And then all of a sudden, now Baylor's starting to press, and it was working like a charm. They're able to come back down 22 points with 10 minutes to go. It was uber impressive, but, I mean, the referees stole the show in this game.
Yeah, they really did. Yeah, they really did. And the Manick ejection, I think, was the principal reason why Baylor was able to come back in this game. Without Manick, this team looked incredibly wobbly. And when Love fouled out, that's when I really got concerned for this North Carolina team. If Baylor ever got a lead in this game, I thought that was it. Right then and there, Baylor was going to win it. But North Carolina, credit to them, they found a way to stay composed. Especially in the overtime, when I thought that Baylor was just going to ride the momentum right then and there and take it in overtime. No, North Carolina stuck together, found a way to get the job done in overtime, which is so critical here. And I'll just spout off on the Manick ejection real quick. Like, listen, the refs are awful. I think we can all agree on that. But I'm coming from this perspective. I don't care how bad or good the refs are. If you're Brady Manick, you're up 25 points. Don't do something stupid. That's what that was. When you're up 25 points, what he did was stupidity.
But it was certainly not warranting an ejection. I mean, he threw an elbow high. It's a flagrant. But you didn't, like, look back and say,
yeah,
oh, there's a guy there. I'm going to throw an elbow at him.
Or he didn't give him, like, a dirty look after the play. I mean, like, it wasn't – it doesn't seem like it was intentional. So I think the only way that it's made to be an ejection if it's seemed – intentional and it wasn't, but Manick is one of the only seniors on this team, and it definitely showed that he is a great leader, because without him they were wobbly, like you said, Nick.
Yeah, and without him I think this North Carolina team is in big trouble. I mean, perhaps the one consistency with the North Carolina's weekend, that it was Kip Kissinger officiating the games. both the first and second rounds. It was Kip Kissinger. So again, I mean, I don't know if anything's worse than Bo, because Bo's got his own John Rothstein tagline. Which, if you're a referee, you got a John Rothstein tagline. That's bad. That's not good. That's bad.
Yeah.
That's bad. But yeah, North Carolina, they just end up finding a way, and they're gonna take on a UCLA team that has all the tournament experience in the world on that team from last year. You can say the same thing about Baylor too. So at that point, it's kind of mute. But man, I'm looking forward so much to North Carolina and UCLA.
Manic isn't out for the first half, is he?
I don't think
it's
so.
Is that like football?
No.
Okay.
Thank God.
College football. Yeah. Let's clarify there.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. But yeah, like I look at this East and it's like North Carolina, UCLA, and then St. freaking Peter's. So all the three who are locked into their spots.
Don't mess with the Peacocks.
Oh my gosh.
I like this Peacock team.
Yeah, this has been a brilliant performance from St. Peter's. But before we get to that, just real quick, the North Carolina UCLA matchup. Just to give a preview of that particular game. This is going to be, I think, one of the most fun matches we'll see in the entire Sweet 16. A couple of power programs, so you know the ratings are going to be high on television, which means Turner and CPS will be incredibly happy. And just looking at the analytical profile, there are not a ton of what I would consider to be analytical mismatches. Perhaps the one here is that UCLA's offense does not turn the ball over too often, and UNC's defense does not force too many turnovers on defense, so that is definitely a matchup that goes in favor of UCLA. But with what North Carolina is playing, this could go either direction.
No, I mean, it absolutely could. And UCLA, they started off pretty slow in both games against Akron and against St. Mary's.
They righted the ship a lot sooner, though, against St. Mary's, though.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And yeah. That wasn't me, like, dissing them. That was me pointing out that, like, hey, now you're facing a team that is red hot, and UNC has played against quality opponents all year, unlike St. Mary's and unlike Akron. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the West Coast Conference was better this year. We've acknowledged that. It's not the ACC. So if North Carolina comes out shooting hot like they have of late in the NCAA tournament and like they did against Duke, UCLA is going to be in trouble.
For sure.
But the way they control the game, I think they'll be in good shape.
Yeah, and UCLA is one of those teams that can throw that. I mean, North Carolina is one of those teams that can throw that knockout punch, and teams like Akron and St. Mary's weren't able to do that against UCLA. So UCLA is definitely going to have to go into this game with a focus on like not taking that knockout punch, not getting down early, because if you get down early against this North Carolina team, I mean, we saw Baylor be able to come back, but I don't think North Carolina is going to slip away two big leads.
Yeah, I mean, if there's ever a team that can absolutely go toe-to-toe with North Carolina based on experience, it is that UCLA team.
Yeah.
They know how to work the grind of the second weekend in particular. As that underdog seed, as North Carolina is in the position of right now. So certainly UCLA knows how to do it, and that will be a terrific game. St. Peter's, let's get to them. Let's just discuss the upset of Kentucky first. And this is where I get on my soapbox and tell Kentucky, if you shoot free throws like that in March, you deserve to lose the game.
Yep.
That was horrific. 1 of 6 in overtime? Oh, gosh. That's the black mark for me right there. I'm circling that in the box score being like, there's your reason, guys. Make your free throws.
You're right. And I turned the game on. They were up by 6, so 3 minutes to go. And I'm like, Kentucky's got this. Like, there's no way they lose to St. Peter's, especially when they're up by 6, 3 minutes to go. Sure enough, St. Peter's, the Peacocks, baby. I mean, they pulled it out. It's astounding. And I mean, we talked about the numbers. All of Coach Cal's assistants are paid more than the head coach at St. Peter's, Shaheen Holloway. And it was also a funny nugget that they pointed out when St. Peter's moved on. Of course, St. Peter's from New Jersey in Jersey City. The last team to make it to the Sweet 16 from New Jersey was Seton Hall in 2000, and their starting point guard with Shaheen Holloway. So he's repping Jersey. And let me tell you, I mean, the way that this defense plays, they're going to have a shot. And they play tough. And they're a really fun team to watch.
Yeah. And then quickly before we get into this, the the St. Peter's 15 seed period of time on the show. The game against Murray State was also terrific.
It was phenomenal.
Yeah, that was a terrific performance for St. Peter's. Despite shooting 3 of 13 from 3, they found a way. And that's what you have to do in March. And against a team, Murray State, that had been terrific in the OVC, had 4 guys score 10 or more points, they found a way. And ultimately, that's what you have to do in March. Find a way to win games. And this St. Peter's team, from the conference tournament to now the NCAA tournament, they've proven they can do that. They can find ways to win these games. And when these teams were pretty even on the turnover battle, St. Peter's had 15 points off 12 turnovers. Murray State just 4 off 10. Though that is a pretty key mark in my estimation. But again, 14 of 17 on free throws in the second half. Making those free throws, making sure you don't let Murray State even remotely close to being in the game. They did that. Just overall a terrific job from the St. Peter's team this entire weekend. And they have certainly put themselves in March Madness lore as an all-time Cinderella.
I think they are the all-time Cinderella. Their story is crazy. I love this St. Peter's team. I love Coach Sheehan Holloway. His confidence and passion is off the charts. And I think they can really dig deep and perhaps knock off a team like Purdue. We'll see what happens in this Purdue-Texas game. But this Cinderella run, I would say, a program like St. Peter's beating a program like Kentucky does way more numbers than what UMBC did to Virginia. Because, for one, Virginia was missing their best player, DeAndre Hunter. And Kentucky, compared to St. Peter's, is astronomical.
Yeah, I mean, the comparison between the two schools, it's just that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a school that, you know, hardly has anything. Small school, you know, going against a Kentucky team that is a blue blood in college basketball. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I mean, it's almost like unlike anything we've ever seen. I mean, Oral Roberts team of last year, just speaking of analytical profiles, was an offensively heavy favorite profile. Guys like Asmus and O'Banner, just a really solid team. Florida Gulf Coast, you know, they didn't excel in one particular thing at all. Offense or defense. There was just kind of middle of the road in both those areas. But what they did, they were pretty elite at inside stuff. Dunk City, you would expect that from them. And again, just another team that was able to just really be flashy and find a way. And, you know, the comparison between these three 15 seeds, the only ones to ever get to the second weekend, each of these teams is very unique in their own particular way.
Yeah.
Which is what I find very interesting. And then there is no trend.
No, I mean, and it's awesome because no one's walking into any of these games.
If I could turn my mic on, that would be really appreciative.
Yeah. No one's really walking into any of these games saying, wow, like, I think these teams, they're going to win, and then they're going to win game two. Like, it just doesn't happen. And the fact that these teams there's now been three teams in the last 10 years to be 15 seeds and move on to the second weekend is pretty incredible. And I think the more and more we see this, it's going to be awesome, and it's never going to lose its merit because these are all, for the most part, really small private schools that don't have a lot going into them. I mean, yeah, you get like the Big West and like some other like public schools going in there as 15 seeds, but for the most part, they're all private schools. I mean, I think Florida Gulf Coast is a private school, obviously. I know St. Peter's and Oral Roberts are, but just pretty phenomenal. These really small schools are able to go up against the big dogs, Georgetown, Ohio State, Kentucky, because it's more rare for these teams to beat the 2 seed than it is to turn around and beat the 7 or the 10.
Yeah, and one of the things I was saying as my mic was off is that like each of these teams has a very unique analytical profile. I mean, Oral Roberts was offensively favored. The St. Peter's team is defensively favored, more of what I like to look at in analytical profiles. FGC was very balanced in that regard. So it's three very unique profiles. And, you know, one of the things I was reading from Steve Politi over at NJ.com, this is a fantastic piece, tweeted about it earlier today. The one thing that really gets me is that within the state of New Jersey, you know, since 1983, Rutgers won NCAA tournament win. Since 1996, Princeton won NCAA tournament win. Since 2004, Seton Hall won NCAA tournament win. This week, St. Peter's, two NCAA tournament wins. Yeah. I mean, forget what St. Peter's has done as a 15 seed and what they have done upsetting some of these teams. Winning NCAA tournament games is rare for New Jersey universities.
It's rare for a lot of teams.
I mean, this is unheard.
Winning in this tournament is as hard as it is, and they've won two, and they may win more than that. So.
I mean, Nebraska doesn't even have an NCAA tournament win.
Ever.
I mean.
Ever? It's close.
I don't think they've ever won one.
Yeah.
Oh, what? How?
I don't know.
That's impossible.
Yeah, because that's one of the other things I'm seeing on Twitter, too. Like, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's nuts. But this is a story that, you know, going into this, I'm just like, back-to-back years, you know, it's just like, getting a little interesting, but oh, Dominic showed me something big in the Midwest. We're going to talk about the Midwest region a little bit later, but Miami, they are crushing Frogburn.
The walk-ons are in.
Oh my gosh.
They're seconds away from going to the Sweet 16.
But these upsets are kind of what they're discussing. Miami would be the fourth double-digit seed to advance to the Sweet 16. We were discussing it earlier before the show. That's the same number as last year, correct?
Yeah, it happened last year. In 2014, there was three double-digit seeds. So pretty remarkable. I'm actually going to add that to the tweet.
I think there's going to be – we're going to see this more often going forward in basketball because the amount of talent – there is in sports in general right now is insane. I mean, I think we're at not peak, but I mean, we're seeing young kids being able to do what 30-year-olds were doing 20 years ago. So athletic ability is a big thing right now, and it's all over the country, not just at the Power 5 schools.
Yeah, and the fact that we've seen 15 seeds back-to-back years get to the Sweet 16 – and I mean, even 4 years ago, that thought would have seemed impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah, here we are. And St. Peter's, what they did in defeating Kentucky, they took out one of the favorites for the championship.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if we could say the same thing about that Georgetown team in 2013.
No.
The Ohio State team last year?
I had them, but that's because I was from Columbus, but...
I mean...
Yeah. It's crazy because I had Kentucky in one of my brackets that I was very confident in. And
I mean, I had them as my national runner-up and my one bracket.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that team with Oscar Tshiebwe would just dominate people.
When Oscar Tshiebwe dominated.
Yeah.
Ty Washington and Kellen Grady did not dominate.
Yeah. And we say that a lot, too. Guard play is what really dictates.
No. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we saw that with this Auburn team that just lost to Miami, and we saw it with an Ohio State team. Because Ohio State has two first-round potential picks in E.J. Liddell and Malachi Branham, but they missed guards, and Auburn missed guards, and Kentucky missed guards. So, yeah, guard play is what constructs the offense, and St. Peter's has that, so that's why they'll be able to beat teams like Kentucky.
Yeah, one last thing before we transition to Michigan. One of the things I'm just not noticing here, the bench minutes percentage. 2013 FGCU was just under 30%, pretty average amongst the country that year, just a little bit below average. The Oral Roberts team last year was just over 22%, way below the average of 31%. St. Peter's, 40.5% bench minutes.
Yeah, so they're a complete team. So
that's going to be something that the freshness... that's going to be something that either Purdue or Texas are going to have to handle. That is going to be quite
especially
something.
Especially Purdue's defense.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
we'll
may end up having a debate more.
Peru.
Oh, gosh. We may have a debate more on the Pacific to the 15 seeds later on down the line. I know we didn't quite get to the debate of that, but just looking back on what St. Peter's has accomplished, it has been remarkable. To Michigan, to the South region, one of the other double-digit seeds, onto the Sweet 16. And first it was Colorado State, I think one that was perhaps a little more predictable of the seeding upsets that we were handed to us.
Michigan was the betting favorite.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, 75-63. Hunter Dickinson, 21-6 with four blocks. He was pretty darn effective. Mm-hmm. Eli Brooks played all 40 minutes, had 16-7 with six assists to go along with that. Second half, 60% from the field. Really, really good performance. They didn't take too many threes. 14 compared to 48 overall shots. Not that they made too many threes, but it seems that they found what worked for them inside, which is ultimately what you have to do. Find what works. Free throw shooting was nearly immaculate, 19 of 22 for the game. It was exactly what they had to do, and most of it came in the second half of this game.
Yep.
60% from the field in the second half for Michigan. Colorado State, just 29%. The free throw shooting, they're going to handle their business there, and that's what they have to do. Just handle business from the line. It's a pillar at this time of the year. Handle your business.
Mm-hmm.
And then against Tennessee, a team that absolutely crushed Longwood, it looked like they were just going to be dancing their way on and try to really avenge the bracketologists, avenge the committee for their seed. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. Not what happened at all, because Hunter Dickinson and Eli Brooks dominated that game.
Yeah. Well, with this Michigan team, I think they're starting to finally show what everyone thought they were going to be at the beginning of the year. Their record does not show what this roster is on paper. Hunter Dickinson is finally showing what he did at the end of last year. So this Michigan team is a very, very good team. So don't let the numbers fool you. Don't let the record, don't let the seeding fool you. Because this Michigan team can do some damage in this tournament.
Yeah, man. I mean, when I printed out the Instagame prep on Michigan, Villanova, the Sweet 16 set, Michigan's a top 30 KenPom team. I mean, it's a good...
It's a rematch of a national final. Two years ago?
In San Antonio.
2018.
Yeah.
In San Antonio.
Yeah.
The exact same place where Villanova beat Michigan for the national title in 2018.
Mm-hmm. They're playing Sweet 16 and Elite Eight games at the Alamo Dome.
In the AT&T Center, but still.
Nah, well, it's not the same place, but I was about to say that would be bonkers if they're playing...
Same city. Same city, okay, same city.
Well, no, but I was just wondering, because that would be electric
if we got any technical about it.
I didn't know. That wasn't me trying to call you out.
Yeah, he's just talking about the size.
Right, because if they were playing Sweet 16 games at the Alamo Dome, that would be nuts.
I mean, they probably want to use half the floor size of that place, but still.
Right, yeah.
But let's get to the actual point of this conversation about Michigan-Tennessee game.
Tennessee just absolutely collapsed late. And credit to Michigan, their defense really stepped up. But it was 60-54 with about 8 minutes to go. And Tennessee got a stop. They had the ball. And from that point on, it was just brick, 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 turnover, turnover, turnover. Kennedy Chandler is fantastic in this game. Outside of that, Tennessee didn't really have anyone they could really depend on. Josiah Jordan James played well, but he went 0 of 6 from 3. You know, they only made 2 threes, 2 of 18. They really let themselves down, and this team was shooting the ball so well. Just in the previous game against Longwood, granted, it was Longwood. They were absolutely killer from three. They put up 88 points. They shot 14 of 24 from three. So, tough look for Tennessee. They couldn't get it done against a Michigan team that they probably should have handled. But once again, Rick Barnes, University of Tennessee, they come up short. They made it to the Sweet 16 that 1 year. In 2019, when that team was absolutely loaded as a two seed, and they had to survive overtime after blowing that massive lead to Luka Garza and Jordan Bohannon at Iowa. But it's just been consistently failing to get deep into the NCAA tournament. That's not to say that Rick Barnes is a bad team, that this program is failing, but at some point, Tennessee's got to get over the hump.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I remember the game against Purdue in the Sweet 16, I think it was 3, 4, 5 years ago. But like, there are a couple Carson Edwards and Ryan Klein threes away from going to the Elite Eight. So yeah. I mean, they're right on the cups, like you said. They're right before the hump. So it's just gonna be interesting to see what they do to get over to the hump eventually, if that ever happens.
Yeah, and you know, the turnover battle. Michigan had 15 turnovers. Tennessee just 7. I mean, the points off turnovers, you can say what you will about that. But again, second half, you know, Michigan didn't quite shoot the three well in that second half. But Tennessee was 0-9. For three, and 2 of 18 overall in the game. Like, if you can't shoot the three ball in March, it shows, and it shows in a big way. And once again, it happened in this game. And you know, that's despite a solid performance from Kennedy Chandler. I mean, 19 with 9 assists is nothing to sneeze at for him.
Oh, it's insane.
Yeah, and the moment between Juwan Howard and Kennedy Chandler at the end of that game is definitely something to
right.
To really take in, but...
And, I mean, we hope that shows more of what Juwan Howard's character is. I mean, we were pretty vocal in our concerns with him. It wasn't the first time he had an altercation with an opposing coach, but it's those types of moments where you're like, all right, we need more of this in college basketball, especially from a leader who's also spent time at the NBA level as a player and as a coach, like Juwan Howard. Those are the more of the moments we want to see to help make basketball better.
Yeah, definitely a scene of March. So it was definitely great to see after what happened in Madison a couple of weeks ago. I mean, I think Juwan Howard's a good coach. I think he got a bad rap for what he did there, but it's certainly not acceptable, but it's definitely a great scene.
Yeah, and just looking at the Michigan-Philadelphia matchup real quick, I think Michigan's defense, at least analytically, on paper, analytically, not the best matchup, but Philadelphia's adjusted efficiency, you can say, is kind of flawed because their percentages aren't the best. Their three-point percentage is solid. But what really sticks out for Philadelphia is that they're the nation's top free-throw shooting team.
They're the greatest free-throw shooting team of all time.
Oh, my gosh. Like, you cannot get into a close game to Philadelphia because they're going to beat you on free throws.
They missed some free throws today, though, against Ohio State. I'm picking Michigan. I think Michigan will be in the Elite Eight.
Well, the thing that's going to be interesting for me is how is the height of Villanova going to hang up? Because Villanova doesn't play anyone that's too tall.
Dickinson and dominates.
You're going to see 7'1" Hunter Dickinson and 6'11" Musa Diabate. It's going to be very interesting because there's no one that plays on Villanova that's higher than 6'8". It's Eric Dixon who plays 63% of minutes, and he plays mostly on the outside. It's going to be fascinating.
And what I will also be interested in, two things. Number one, Villanova has a full year of experience compared to Michigan. Villanova has 2.4 years of experience from Ken Palm Spencer compared to Michigan's 1.4.
Mm-hmm.
And the two foul participation rate on both these teams is incredibly low. Foul trouble might be a thing to watch in that first half.
Yeah, especially if Dickinson and Diabate get really physical, if Houston plays physical, because, of course, he's a 6'9" wing. And, Dom, Villanova went 17 of 20 from the free throw line.
But they missed a couple of front ends. So.
Yeah, right. They'll miss some, but they shoot 84% from the free throw line, which is absurd.
No, it's absurd.
They're robots.
I just remember the ones they missed because they didn't happen that often.
Right, so. Yeah. So they're a dependable team, but I really like the way Michigan matches up with them.
No, me too.
I think that's they can take advantage of Villanova's weakness, which is lack of depth and lack of height.
Mm.
Height.
Yeah, we'll click in a couple of minutes before we get to the West region. Houston, really good week from them.
They're number two in KenPom now.
Yeah.
It's annoying.
Ain't that something? KenPom is up there just smiling right now. I mean, should Arizona beat TCU, what could Houston do?
They can do anything they want. I mean, Kelvin Sampson is a great coach, and people need to give him the respect that he deserves. So, I think Houston, Arizona could be one of the best games of the Sweet 16 round for sure. Houston's definitely capable of beating them. Arizona's size may give them some issues, but it's definitely a game I would look forward to if Arizona gets it done against TCU tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be up to Josh Carlton, 6'11" center for Houston to play really well. Because with the height of Arizona, especially Christian Coloco, he's already at 18 points right now against TCU. You're going to be challenged. You also have Umar Ballo, Tubelis down low. That's where they're going to have the challenge because I think Houston has the advantage in the backcourt. But in the front court, Arizona smokes them. But Carlton, fantastic player, shoots 62% from the floor. He's been fantastic this year. He's going to have to play really well because he did a good job of locking up Kofi Coburn. And they were just trapping every time he got the ball, seemingly. You know, Kofi put up 19 points because he went 7-7 from the free throw line. But he shot six. He only shot 11 times from the floor. I mean, Illinois was just so bad offensively. 17 turnovers. And it was the same thing that happened to them against Loyola Chicago last year in the second round.
Mm-hmm.
Their offense just looked pitiful.
Yeah, and there's a lot of forwards that were playing in that game for Houston. Josh Carlton took up 19 minutes. Fabian White Jr. took up 27 minutes. Juwan Roberts took up 12. Reggie Chaney took up 20. They're going to have to find a guy that will go up against Arizona's kids because those dudes are smart, they are physical, and they're
fast.
They can dominate inside. Yeah. So that's going to be the matchup to watch. Sure, Arizona get it done, but it looks like I'm assuming they are doing pretty well against TCU right now.
It's 32-29. But after they were down 8-0. And the other game, Purdue's up 40-37, just 3 minutes in the second half.
Okay, that's interesting. To move on over to the West region, where we do have a complete set of the Sweet 16 games, a chalk advance, including the Duke Blue Devils. They take care of business against Cal State Fullerton in the first round. For this second round game, is one game I want to talk about. 85-76 over Michigan State. A fouling effort for Michigan State. I know Dob and I were watching the tail end of this game in the First Amendment Forum. Great performances, really all around both teams.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a great way to end Izzo versus Coach K. I guess you could say rivalry, but I mean, what was the record? It was 8-3, Coach K all time against Tom Izzo.
I believe it.
Yeah. So Coach K definitely dominated the matchup. And it was a valiant effort, like you said, Nick. I mean, Duke was down for most of the game, but the way they were able to play fast and play like close defense and get the ball running in transition, that's what Duke's staple is, and they were able to do that in the very end, and that's where it really got them the victory.
Yeah, I mean, Michigan State needed 7 of 10 shooting from three just to be down by 4 at halftime. Mm-hmm. Like that is something really remarkable, as Duke shot 57% from the field, 15 of 28 in the first, 17 of 28 in the second. Just a really good performance on the interior for Duke. They knew their specialty was to get it inside, you know, take those twos, get your points down there when you can, because they have really special guys down there, like a Banchero, like a Mark Williams. AJ Griffin's injury was kind of unfortunate to him, but up until that point, he wasn't playing too terribly for him. Wendell Moore did his business from the line, but he was pretty solid where he was needed as well. I mean, just a Duke team that, you know, going into this tournament, I was worried for them in pressure games. And this certainly looked like a pressure moment for Duke.
It looked like they were going to fold. In the last 5 minutes of the game, they played their best basketball this season. Yep. They were phenomenal shooting, and they really locked up Michigan State anytime anyone got to the hoop. You saw Mark Williams, you saw Banchero and their big bodies. They got to the hoop and they played great defense. And the defense had been the question with this team entering the NCAA tournament. They really stood up to the test. Fantastic ending. I was super impressed by Duke at the very end, because John Rothstein has really hammered home, and it's been annoying. He says Duke's got the highest ceiling of any team in the country. I tell you what, if they play defense remotely close to how they were playing the last 5 minutes, they play offense remotely close to how they were playing that last 5 minutes, this Duke team could be cutting down the nets in San Francisco and also cutting them down in New Orleans.
Yeah, because I mean, that's the thing about this Duke team. Like, now you got Texas Tech to worry about, who survived an incredible bid from Notre Dame to take them down. And that Texas Tech team, what a difference of two games. I mean, they just dominate Montana State and then just survive against Notre Dame. And I still believe that's going to be quite the tough matchup for Duke, the way Texas Tech's style is. But seeing the way Duke can play in the last 5 minutes, you know, rise above the pressure, which going into this tournament, the last couple of big pressure games, we hadn't seen that from Duke, the ability to rise above the pressure. You better believe that Duke's going to be one of the favorites now to win this region.
Well, it's going to be them and Gonzaga.
Yeah.
And the way Texas Tech plays offensively against good teams, I have my concerns. I think Duke should beat them, and then I think it should set up a Gonzaga Duke game.
A rematch at the start of the year.
You think Duke should win a game against Texas Tech handily?
I do, yeah.
Oh, okay. I disagree, but
I do too. I think that's gonna be a really close game. Yeah. Like, I like both those teams.
What's different from Michigan State and Texas Tech?
Well, Texas Tech plays better defense, but Tech, that neither team's great offensively, but I just think Duke, when they can prepare for Texas Tech, I think they're going to have more time. They have way more playmakers than anyone that Texas Tech has faced in a little bit.
Yeah, because Texas Tech, they're such a unit, you know? Like,
their defense is phenomenal. They're the best defense in the country.
And they're such a unit when they do that. Like, I think I was talking with you when the Big 12 defensive team came out, and I'm just like, no Texas Tech players, what are we doing here?
Yeah, no, that was bad.
It's because they're such a unit when they do. Like,
they swarm you.
Yeah, like there's not one guy that stands out because of the way that defense runs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they will get at you, they will swarm you, and it's all about the team element. Mm-hmm. There's not one guy that's getting the job done on its own. Like, if that defense is getting anything done, there's two or more guys involved in the action all the time.
No, Texas Tech is one of those teams that makes college basketball special. Just the way they play defense is beautiful. I love every second. It reminds me of Aaron Kraft. I mean, I'm a Ohio State guy, so I'm going to love defense like this anytime I can get it. So I think Texas Tech can play close against this Duke team.
There you go. I mean, I said I think they'll probably win by 8 or so points.
Which, if that's down to free throws, like, that's a pretty close game. Like, if that comes down to free throws to the tail end, which, if that's going to be the way it is, I suspect that's the way it's going to be done. You know, really hard-fought free throws at the tail end.
Sure.
Like that's kind of the way I would envision an eight-point game going. And that's certainly going to be quite the interesting spot because, I mean, Arkansas and Gonzaga is the other matchup in this region, in the Sweet 16. And looking at the analytics, I mean, just from a numbers perspective and shooting.
Arkansas is in trouble.
Big trouble. Big trouble. I cannot emphasize this enough that when you look at the analytics of Arkansas's offense compared to Gonzaga's defense, oh boy, Arkansas, especially down low, is in trouble.
Yeah.
They're in huge trouble.
It's all right. Jalen Williams is going to draw like 5 charges on Drew Timmy and Chet Holmgren. And,
Oh, gosh.
Well, I mean, I said before the tournament that Memphis was Gonzaga's biggest test before the Elite Eight. And if they can get past Memphis, they'll be in the Elite Eight for sure.
They stood strong to that test.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, the defense is elite. The offense is elite. I mean when I printed out the game prep, Gonzaga, offensively and defensively, number one in effective field goal percentage. And that's on both sides of the ball.
Yeah, they got some help from the Jackrabbits putting up a bunch of contested layups and just chucking up threes against Fraudvidence because they were number one in effective field goal percentage on offense at 61%. And then, of course, are nowhere near that now. It's obviously good credit to Gonzaga because they deserve to be up there. But Arkansas does not shoot the three ball well, and Gonzaga's got the number one 2-point percentage defense in the country. It could get really ugly in San Francisco.
It's good to know now, too, that Arkansas is just a little bit above average in the 2-point percentage offensively, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit above average, about 6/10 of a percentage point higher than the national Division I average. But on three, they are 3 percentage points below average. They're sub-300 nationally in the ranking on 3-point percentage. And if Gonzaga is going to force this Arkansas team to go out there, that's trouble. That is huge trouble. And it seems like Gonzaga's got a pretty, well, I'm not going to say safe spot because this March, who the hell knows. But Gonzaga, you come up against the Elite against Duke or Texas Tech, that's a fantastic matchup.
Yeah.
Either way.
Especially because Tech played them relatively close and Duke beat them. Oh, that was Gonzaga's first loss of the year. So,
yeah.
I think either way, you're going to be getting a really good game in San Francisco this weekend.
Yeah. I think all the Elite Eight games will be pretty good. Maybe not the Midwest region, just because
we'll talk about it.
Yeah,
we'll talk about it. But that Gonzaga-Memphis game, I do want to just go to say a few words on this before moving on to the Midwest region. For everything Gonzaga had, particularly that second half, Memphis had an answer. When Memphis was in foul trouble, some of their bigs, I'm like, oh boy, this might be it. This might be the point where Gonzaga starts to run away, especially inside. No.
Yeah.
Gonzaga, when they put up a shot and went in, Memphis found an answer. And sometimes that was out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But they found an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing I was so impressed by Memphis, was the ability to just fight and fight and continue to fight and stay in the game, stay in contention throughout the course of that second half. Like, with 4 fouls on Durham, 4 fouls on Nolly, and even Willis is in that same spot. I mean, when they had, was it Dangridge that was out there? Like, when he was, like, gassed in that second half, that could have easily been the moment where that was it. I mean, Penny Hardaway looked like he went to the Bobby Hurley School of Timeouts for a moment. Like, it was just, I was scared for Memphis, but they found a way to stay in that game. And given the arc of this Memphis team, that's so impressive.
For sure. I think the last 2.5 weeks cooled down Penny Hardaway's seat for sure. So
I was in the last like month that has done that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been so impressive to see what they've done over that last period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I come away so impressed with by that Memphis team. We'll get to Miami here in a moment. Because in the Midwest region, we have the Chalk, Providence, moving on to the Sweet 16.
Kansas, too.
And that game against Creighton was a good one, too.
Mm-hmm. It was scary for the Jayhawks.
Yeah,
sure.
Man. Shout out to Arthur Kaluma, 24-12 for Creighton in this game. We did a really nice job inside. But at the end of the day, I mean, you guys got Remy Martin off the bench. That team's dangerous.
Very.
Yeah, I guess I didn't come out publicly and say this. I switched my national championship pick in my bracket to Kansas after doing a deeper dive. I mean, this Kansas team is super impressive. Heading into the tournament, and they showed it offensively. Their defense got very shaky against a Creighton team that's not very deep and doesn't shoot the three ball well. Made just two threes in the round of 64 game, which we don't need to talk about. But they went 12 of 28 from three against Kansas. Kansas has to close out better against three-point shooters coming up here against Providence, because Providence is shooting the ball really well at the moment. They hadn't been all year. That's why they're a Providence. But, I mean, if you're Kansas, you got to be thankful that Iowa fell, because Iowa was playing such good basketball.
Absolutely. And you look at this Kansas team, Remy Martin did most of his work in the first half. Yeah. 16 of his 20 points came there.
Right, and then he tried to shoot Kansas out of the game, which is what we saw a lot at Arizona State.
Yeah, and what we saw with the... You know, with Kansas, we opened, it ended up being Ajabi with his 13 points in the second half that ended up being pretty darn key. Mm-hmm. And then Jalen Wilson also 6.6 boards in the second half as well. He was a pretty darn good factor as well in that second half, as was Christian Braun. This team has so many guys that can just really take it to you in any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have Martin come off that bench, that is so dangerous for that Kansas team. And then Providence as well, which I did talk with Ryan Sikora earlier today, and he told me when I had the Instagame prep from Camp Home out for this Providence game, he told me, this sheet doesn't matter no more. I see what I see, and he doesn't trust Kansas in close games. And we all know what Providence in close games are. It's a match made in heaven. So who knows, really? But the big reason this, the big headline is that we have...
A 10 versus 11.
We have chaos.
In the bottom of this bracket.
Oh, my gosh. It's chaos.
Ugly.
Yeah, and Iowa State did not hit 60 points in either game.
Ugh.
54-49 against Wisconsin. 59-54 against LSU.
I hate it.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you have to give credit where credit is due in this. I mean, it's been different guys that have taken over. In the first round game against Wisconsin, it was Colasur with 22 points, 10 of 19 from the field. He was the one that was really leading the charge alongside Isaiah Brockington, who had 10 but a poor shooting night. Second game, Tyrese Hunter was the guy with he had 23 points. And Isaiah Brockington, his shooting improved. He had 19 points.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting that Colasur in that game only had 4 points. Tyrese Hunter in the first game only had 4 points on a poor shooting night. Same thing with Colasur, poor shooting night, 1 of 7. First game, Tyrese Hunter, 1 of 10. I keep bouncing back and forth because the parallels are so key. It's the one guy coming out, standing out, and quite frankly, that makes this team dangerous.
And their defense makes this team dangerous too. I mean, they held Johnny Davis today for 0 for 7 from 3. And Wisconsin as a team only made 2 total threes.
Two of 22. Yeah, I was just going to say that. Less than 10%.
Yeah, ugly.
And that's something you cannot do. I know you can say, yes, but Iowa State was 3 of 14 and 3. When that defense is 4 of 2 of 22... That speaks a little bit louder to me than 3 of 14.
Yeah, that's coaching, too. Like, if you're not making threes, you got to change your game plan and put it inside. I mean, Wisconsin doesn't really have the bigs as it normally does. Like, for example, Ethan Happen, Frank Kaminsky. But Johnny Davis is a player. He's a leader. And you have to understand, if you're not making your shots from outside, you got to get it in the hole. And Iowa State did a great job all night long on the defensive end. So props to them. But tough scene for the Badgers and Greg Gard to go down this early.
Yeah, especially for Johnny Davis, who was such a great player this season. And but he did most of his work in the free throw line, which included between 17 points, 9 boards. I mean, by all stretch of the imagination, that's not a bad performance.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly Brad Davidson. I feel for him as well with his 12 points, 4 steals, 4 boards, 4 assists.
He can finally go work in an adult job now since he's been in college for 30 years.
Yeah, I think Nick, you're the only person in the country that's not a Wisconsin Badgers fan. It's like, I feel for Brad Davidson.
He finally can do an adult job now.
He's developed quite the reputation in the Big Ten.
But it's like he's one of those guys that's been there forever. I mean, you would like to see him get that run, especially as a three. But it is
He has 2 Big Ten titles. He's fine.
Yeah, and that's something to credit. That in and of itself is a fantastic career to have 2 conference titles. Forget the Big Ten, 2 conference titles. That is really impressive. And LSU also have 3 guys as well. Darius Day's at 14 and 12 and just a terrific performance. Tanner Eason had 18 on a pretty solid shooting night. Didn't take too many threes, did what he's supposed to inside. And the rest of his team, I mean, 4 of 19 from 3 for the whole team. That's just abysmal. And Iowa State improved from there, especially Tyrese Hunter, 7 of 11. Caleb Grill kind of brought it down a little bit with his 2 of 11 performance from 3.
Yeah.
But regardless, I mean, this is an Iowa State team that just keeps on fighting, and they force turnovers in both these games.
Yeah.
That's a big parallel.
Yeah.
That's what makes them so dangerous against Miami.
They force the 5th most turnovers in the nation per possession rate. And we've talked about it. The teams that typically make runs further than you'd expect them to in March are teams that play great defense because defense travels. The defense is always going to be there. But it's then when you can step it up just a little bit offensively. That's what they've been able to do. Obviously, they haven't been great, as we highlighted. They did not score 60 points in either game.
But they get the job done.
Their defense was so stout that they didn't have to, and they deserve a lot of credit. T.J. Otzelberger turned this program around year one. How many games did they win last year, guys?
Two?
They won 2 games last year. They've won 2 games in this NCAA tournament. That's astounding.
Yeah, it really is. And Iowa State epitomizes this tournament. We've seen a lot of low-scoring games in this tournament.
It's weird. It's definitely, especially since, like, we were so high on offense all regular season long, and then now it gets down to the nit and gritty. So Iowa State is one of those teams that if you're having one off night, they're going to take advantage of it and punch you in the throat.
Yeah, and let's talk about Miami real quick. I don't know any of the box scores in front of me, but for them to just obliterate Auburn, or Frogburn.
Thank you, Nick.
There we go.
I wrote that in the tweet.
I was just about to get to that. It depends on what we've seen from Auburn this year. They have not been good away from home, and Miami had just took advantage of almost, it seemed like almost anything they got.
No, Auburn looked horrible. Wendell Green was horrible in this game, and so was Jabari Smith, projected a top 5 pick, and that's not to say he shouldn't be a top 5 pick, but this Auburn team is currently entered this game at 12th, and KenPom was projected to win this game by 8, and they lost it by 13. So the fraudulentness was starting to come out pretty heavily towards the end of the regular season. Like I mentioned in the SEC bracket breakdown when I said they'd lose in the first round to Florida and then they lost in the first round to A&M. There are so many times in this tournament and also in the conference tournaments where I knew this team was going to lose. I just had them losing to the wrong team.
Yeah.
But to end the season, on the road at Missouri, they won by 1. At Georgia, they won by 2. Lost at Arkansas, which was a very good game. Lost at Florida. Lost at Tennessee. Very good game. Overtime at Mississippi State. Lost in a neutral floor against A&M. Didn't cover against Jacksonville State. And then got killed by Miami. Just awful. Mm-hmm. Just awful. Yeah.
And I will tell you this. Like this, an 11-10 game between two power conference schools. I really do wonder what the Sickos Committee thinks about this.
It's weird.
It is mind-boggling weird.
Two power conference teams.
Double-digit seeds. Yep. ACC versus Big 12.
Mm-hmm.
What the freaking heck are we... Like, who puts the buttons on this matchup in their bracket?
At half, Arizona's up by 3.
Interesting.
There you go. That's in the South region.
I wanted to give props, though, to Coach Jim LaVernega for the Miami Hurricanes. I mean, this is going to be his third Sweet 16 appearance for while he's coaching term at Miami. So Miami has been able to do a lot of damage this year. They beat Duke on the road. So I'm happy for the Hurricanes. And they do have a pretty solid team. So I think they will beat Iowa State and move on to the Elite Eight.
And it's a fact, too, that we're guaranteed to see Iowa State or Miami in the Elite Eight.
Yeah.
Yes.
Prime time television.
Yes. And that is the Sicko laugh, by the way, for those who absolutely don't know, because...
That's just the Nick Hodel laugh, too.
Yeah. I mean, someone could Photoshop that and it'd be accurate at this point. Someone could Photoshop it and it'd be so accurate. But... In the last few minutes that we have, I know on the rundown it says Bonanza Rank. This could be more of a discussion topic, too. We've talked about all 4 regions, some more in depth than others, I have to admit, particularly the East. But the teams now that we have almost everyone in the Sweet 16, obviously there are a couple of games still outstanding. You mentioned Arizona, TCU. What's going on in Purdue, Texas? at this moment?
It is 51-46 Purdue, and they're shooting free throws.
Okay.
12 minutes to go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'm sure the people on the podcast platform already know by then, but we were recording live. That's the update. Really, I wanted to get your thoughts in the last few minutes we have. Who do you guys think, this could be each region, this could be overall, the teams that you think are in the best position to make the Final Four?
It's easily Purdue and Kansas.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even close.
Purdue and Kansas?
Yes. And I think it's more Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more Kansas, too. I mean, I've always been concerned, though, about Purdue's defense. Like,
yeah.
Is that not going to get them at some point between either North Carolina or UCLA?
Purdue's attempted 31 free throws in this game.
Oh.
Holy moly.
Wow.
That's ugly.
And they're going to more free throws. They're double bonus.
There's 10 minutes left in the second half, and they've already shot 33 free throws.
And they're in double bonus this half. Which brings me
to that point of...
That's ugly.
I would just die to see Purdue and North Carolina face off in the Elite Eight with the bigs of those teams.
Yeah,
I would die to see that matchup.
Hawkeyes against Edie would be pretty cool, too, for UCLA.
And Cody Riley and Miles Johnson.
Yeah. Like, I just think that... I don't think it's a shoe-in for Purdue.
It's a shoe. Okay, I guess it's a shoe-in for the Elite Eight.
Yes. I mean, for the Final Four, I don't think Purdue's in that best position compared to Kansas.
Well, it's March, so you really can't put a shoe-in for any team.
I know.
But
I know.
Kansas is pretty easy.
Why can't St. Peter's beat Purdue? No, I'm just kidding.
Purdue's defense analytically.
Jaden Ivey is top two player in the country, in my opinion.
And it seems like their offensive numbers analytically have not mattered. So it's just like, what the heck? Like,
I'm just doing it for the Big Ten's sake. We need it.
So. But no, on a realist, before we continue on with the conversation, what we're actually having, do you think that game will go more like the Florida Gulf Coast 3-16 game or the Oral Roberts 3-16 we saw last year?
Well, just for a reminder, Oral Roberts in the Sweet 16, they were able to... They're able to have a shot at the end to potentially win that game. I'm trying to pull up the box score from the Georgetown. All right, I finally found it. Georgetown, Florida Gulf Coast, and here it is. They lost by 12 to Florida, who I believe went on to win the national championship. No, they did not. They lost to Michigan in the Elite Eight. But if you're Florida Gulf Coast, I mean, they still like put up a good fight against a, like, at that point, blue blood program. Not blue blood, but a good program. So I think it'll probably be in between there.
I want to add, though, that Oral Roberts is the best 15 seed of all time. They had no business being a 15 seed, especially having a guard like Max Abrams. So Oral Roberts is a completely different team than St. Peter's. Not saying St. Peter's is a bad team, but I can't really think you can put those two teams in the same conversation. Then again, I think the Purdue-St. Peter's game will be close. I think Purdue will get it done. But I do think it'll be less than 12 points.
Yeah, back to the point of the conversation. I think Kansas East is in that best position to get to the Final Four. I mean, unless we see more chaos, which could very well happen in the Midwest, because it was dubbed as a region of vulnerability for a region.
Yep.
That region has gone crazy. The South. I mean, can we really say that other than Villanova, there's a team that's in the best position? Because Arizona get off of that game is going to be really good.
No, I mean,
really good.
Michigan, Villanova, and Arizona, Houston, if that happens, those two games will be less than 5 points. Will come down to the final possessions. They'll be, I think, the two best games in the Sweet 16 if Texas Tech doesn't go my way. But, there's no shoe-in for any of those four teams in that bracket.
Tied at 52, 9.5.
Woo!
Oh, my God.
Uh-oh.
Purdue.
Uh-oh.
Peru.
And then also in the West.
Matt Painter.
I'm not going to say shoe-in Gonzaga, but I think Gonzaga is in the best position of anyone in the bracket. Arkansas, very favorable matchup.
Yes.
And then it's just a matter of who comes out of the other game in that region. To which I would say...
Both of those teams, Texas Tech and Duke, can give Gonzaga issues.
Yeah, I mean, there will be a very competitive Elite Eight game.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not make any mistake about it. But I still think Gonzaga would have at least somewhat of an edge.
Yeah, I mean, they're the best team in college basketball, according to analytics, so...
And it seems like a team that has earned that spot, just based off being able to pull away from a 16 seed that gave them all the fight in the world, a battle to the game against Memphis, like... They know the warning signs of what can happen. Like, they know the warning signs of if they do this, they will get an unnecessarily close game. They know it. And I expect them to just obliterate Arkansas, and then who knows against another game. But then again, everything else I've said this tournament has been wrong, so who knows? That could be wrong, too.
I mean, if it happens, I would love a Gonzaga-UCLA rematch in the Final Four.
Oh, my. Yes.
Yeah, I just thought about that. That would be pretty musty television.
Oh, my gosh.
Especially that, the way that that game ended last year.
Oh, yeah. Ratings through the roof.
And one thing that I'd really be looking for, too, I mean, we talked about it in that South region, is that Arizona, we remember the time that they really put themselves on the on everyone's watch was when they absolutely dominated Michigan and Las Vegas.
Yeah, it wasn't even close.
Oh, it was one of the worst games of the year.
And I would love that. That would be a good rematch, especially the way this now that Michigan team is playing right now.
Hunter Dickinson's got in a groove. He was probably playing hurt at the beginning of the year, if we're being honest. Diabate's really got settled in at the college level. So I think that would be a really fun game to watch, too, because I think that Arizona-Villanova would be a horrible game. I think Arizona would run them off the floor.
Yeah.
Because
Villanova has no
we
size.
We just talked about the size for Villanova against against Michigan's two bigs. Now you get four bigs for Arizona.
You get the longest team in the country.
And now Purdue's up by seven, just quick 7-0 run. The last
I mean, I know
and a half.
All three of us want a Purdue-Michigan final, just for the Michigan State national championship, Purdue-Michigan.
For the Big Ten's sake. For the Big Ten's sake.
Yeah.
For the Big Ten's sake. Don't fool me there. That's for the Big Ten's sake. Yeah, the Big Ten is dying for a national champion. But that will conclude this show. We'll again quickly on Tuesday we'll have our after party episode Tuesday morning, and we're going to discuss the coaching carousel. I tried so hard to avoid it to the tournament, but it's gotten to a point where it has become unavoidable. We will discuss it Tuesday morning, 8 a.m. Arizona time, on your preferred podcast platforms. We'll also have a special episode featuring myself from the NIT and some of the other tournaments taking place. Not quite sure when that'll go up quite yet, but it will be up at some point. But for Dom Contini, Dominic Stern, and Nicholas Hodel from the Bill Austin Radio Studios here in Phoenix, Arizona, giving you one shining moment like we had at the start of things. And we will see you next week here on Blaze Radio for a Final Four show. And throughout the week for all kinds of other college basketball talk, we will see you then.